Welcome to Artists and Ancestors, a podcast where we explore ways to research and understand the past. Whether you're a local historian, genealogist, or just interested in learning about the everyday creative lives of people and the things that they made, this program is for you. I'm John Kay, your host of Artists and Ancestors. Hello and welcome to this episode 16 of Artists and Ancestors, Found Images. In this episode, we talk with Emmy Award-winning archival image researcher Rich Remsburg, who assists documentary filmmakers in locating the necessary archival footage and still photographs that they need to visually tell their stories. From scouring collections at the National Archive to tracking down the rare one-of-a-kind materials held in personal and family collections, he prides himself on uncovering images that even the most ardent scholars have never seen. Rich is also the author of a new book based upon the images from the Farm Security Administration, or FSA, archive. Hard Luck Blues is the name of the book, which pulls together an amazing collection of images featuring musicians recorded by the FSA in the 1930s. He's also the curator of Found in the Archives, a national public radio series that features archival films and found images uncovered by Rich. His work can be found online at www.atlasfilms.org. Let's move on into our interview with Rich.
I'm Rich Remsburg. I'm a freelance archival image researcher, and I work, about half my work is for PBS documentaries, and the other half is for a mix of National Geographic and History Channel and museum exhibits.
How did you get started doing that,
Rich? I read a magazine article about similar sort of thing. I was living in Bloomington and working as a photographer. And I was reading a photo magazine that had an article about people who freelanced at the National Archives doing footage research for historical documentaries. And I thought, wow, that sounds like exactly what my brain was made for. And around the same time, I was getting to know Steve Kroenke, who's a producer at WTIU in Bloomington at the PBS station. And he gave me a couple of assignments. I liked it. I was good at it, and I liked it better than shooting the photographs. So I started doing it about half and half. I was still shooting assignments, and the other half doing research. And I did that for about a year and a half, and then we moved to New England. And when we made the move, I just decided that I wanted to do this full time. And we were moving closer to Boston, which is where most documentaries come out of, and it just put me in a better position to do this kind of work. So that was over 7 years ago, and I've been doing it full time since.
That's great. So you started out as a photographer and photojournalist, and slowly kind of moved towards doing some of this historical work. You were also...
That's right. I had a background in museums and libraries when I was younger. And one thing I came to realize is that with my photography is I was trying to cram historical stories into a present-day photography. And once I realized that, the doing historical research just made a lot more sense.
I remember us talking a while back about... your kind of found images work that you were doing. You love to go through antique malls and find these old images. Did that factor into that, or was that a byproduct of it?
All part of the same brain, I guess. Those are the wild cards, or, you know, there's a phrase that Hank Sapoznik uses that I love, of the rough-hewn promise. And he used that talking about folk music, but it applies just as much to vernacular photography, I think, that there's, you know, when you get these things that are outside of conventional training and outside of the canon, there's just such a wildness to them and such an organic quality. And people just come up with visual solutions or visual transparency to the past that you just can't find in cultivated photography. and I don't know, it just makes my heart race to see that stuff. And I also I really like the sorting process. I think that's part of our hunter-gatherer brain that's still with us. And I just love the process of going through a box of photographs and sifting through photo, 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 and finding the five or six out of the 100 or the 1,000 that are there that are really outstanding images. And with vernacular photography, you just get the opportunity to do that in a way that, unlike anything else, you just hit a flea market or hit a junk shop and find a box of photos and start going to it. And as far as how that relates to the conventional research, there's the same sort of sorting and sifting process involved with what I'll call legit research as well. But what I really like in doing research, when it's for me, when it's really the most exciting, is when it's a combination of the conventional research of knowing the cataloging systems at the National Archives or just doing something at the Library of Congress or local historical society that's very by the book. And you can combine that with finding old guys with cool stuff in their basements, people who brought stuff home from the office or used to work for the government and took things home when they were getting rid of it. And when you combine those two, it just creates such an electric dynamic of the conventional and the wild that I'm really attracted to.
I've seen some of your work online, clips that you've pulled together on your website, Atlas Films. Really interesting pulling together of images that you have there, as well as other footage. I was thinking it might be great if you could tell us about the process. How do you find your work? How do you start a project? What are some of your research skills? That's actually probably a dozen questions in one.
Yeah,
But,
right. Okay, so for the next 2 hours, I will be describing. It varies from project to project. Ideally, for a full-length documentary film, I'm brought in early on to do just sort of an initial research survey, where they'll give me a topic, the producer will give me a topic, and I'll pull together what, not everything, but a good starting amount of material to give the producer a sense of the archival landscape. So, what footage, still photographs, sometimes maps, rare books, engravings, fine art, whatever media are relevant to the certain subject, and what's available from the public institutions like the National Archives or Library of Congress or the National Library of Medicine, or, just there's a number of public places that tend to make material available less expensively when it's in the public domain. And then also the commercial sources, so stock footage houses, stock photo agencies, whatever relevant historical societies there are, like a state historical society or a local historical society or any kind of thematic museum. And then private collectors. I'll just gather up whatever material is the low-hanging fruit, and that's that how I do that varies from project to project. Some of it is systematic and some of it is intuitive and just trying to think the problem of where is this stuff likely to be. And then I'll write that up into a document. And although with changing technology, that document gets more and more complicated. Sometimes it's a database and there's film clips involved. And I'll pass that on to the producer and the editor and we'll go over it and they'll make selects of what they're interested in. And I'll get screening tapes from that, and then they'll do the offline edit with that material. And then closer to the end of the project, when we're ready to go online, they'll give me a shot list of everything that's in the final production, and I'll order masters and clear the rights for that. Concurrent with in between all that is we're going back and forth from that original research document to what other stuff I'm finding that they can write the script around and incorporate into the show. And they're also letting me know what holes they have that they need to fill. And then I try to fill those or let them know that that's not going to happen. And I, you know, I never say that something doesn't exist because, you know, material can turn up in a lot of different places. And usually we just use the term beyond the scope of the project, that it's just not feasible to do a deeper research. Or then it's the producer's call. If they want me to really spend some time and money looking for something, they can, but they know what they're getting into. And then eventually through this back and forth, we have all the material we need to finish the show. And we do. And like I said, then I get the masters and clear the rights for it.
So you actually end up doing some of the negotiation of rights and all of that part.
Oh, yeah, all the time.
Okay. Can you share maybe a aha moment, you know, that point where you thought, well, I can't believe I found this, or I would have never thought that this existed type of thing?
Yeah.
I'm sure you get into that.
Yeah, there's on every job I try to find at least one thing that the people who are hardcore about a subject weren't aware existed. And I don't manage to do that in every project, but a lot of them. And I certainly try in every project. I found a film of Rin Tin Tin that was previously unknown one time that was just in the back room at the Library of Congress. And I guess for me, one of the... it's funny. It's kind of like, you know, because I'm always bragging about these things, but then when you ask me about them specifically, it's like saying, oh, tell me a joke. I guess one of them that I found is one that seems to have no public appeal, but it's an early piece of banjo footage at UCLA. It's Fred Van Epps, who is a popular banjo player in the early 1900s. And there's this film of him. It's an early experimental film from 1921, which is 5 years before sound really hit motion pictures. And it's of his trio playing. It's a dynamite film. And it's at UCLA. It wasn't completely unknown, but largely unknown. And there were donor restrictions on it for 50 years or so. So no one had ever really seen it. And I managed to get those donor restrictions lifted, and we're now using the film we're now using that piece of footage in a film on the history of the banjo. In banjo circles, that one's a really exciting one. For the rest of the public, it doesn't always play so well.
They're probably out there people going, banjo circles? Are there really such a thing?
Yeah, right. Another esoteric one. It's always the esoteric ones that, I mean, by definition. The best project that I've ever worked on from a research standpoint was a PBS American Experience film called The Living Weapon on the history of biological warfare. And I have like almost zero intrinsic interest in the subject, but as a research sport, it was just the best thing I've ever worked on, and maybe ever will. It was that great combination of the legit research and the people who had interesting stuff in their basement that we managed to track down. And because of the sensitive nature of the subject, there were a lot of Freedom of Information Act requests and, just a lot of trying to get classified material or otherwise sensitive material. But there was also all this material at the National Archives, film footage and photographs, that wasn't classified. It's just nobody had ever asked for it before, since it was originally shown in the 40s. And I've managed to find a number of really interesting films on biological warfare that were just there under dust. And one of them was just labeled, there's also not much cataloging on them, so one of them was just labeled Q Fever. And that was, I knew that Q Fever was one of the diseases that they had done human experimentation tests on, with human subjects. And there's not very much information, visual information supporting those tests. Actually, there's quite a bit, but it's all still classified out in Utah. And we were able to get a lot through Freedom of Information, but not not those movies. Anyway, I found this short clip of Q fever test, and it wasn't really enough to use by itself in the documentary, but it was enough to for the art director to build a recreation around it. So we were able to film a recreation, which would normally I don't care for recreations in documentaries, but I thought this one really kind of worked. And then we incorporated in the original footage into that too. So I find that the dynamic of things hiding in plain sight to be just as exciting as having to really dig and be persistent with FOIA requests. And again, it's all part of the dynamic whole that makes it exciting.
One of the things that I've always been surprised with my historical folklife research that I do is the fact that you can find stuff that, you know, people do have them in their home, that images, old acetate sound recordings of family members and things, that if you just go asking for, you find it.
that's really true. When I lived in Bloomington, I was Rich Martin, who was he's a friend of mine who now lives in Champaign, but he used to live in Bloomington also, and we both collected 78 records. And we were driving one time and talking about, you know, where the 78s were still hiding out, and he was talking about, you know, that house has it, that one doesn't, and like, how do we get into it? And I remember this story about Barry Hansen. He's the guy who does the Dr. Demento show, and he's a real serious 78 collector. And he was into it early, so like in the 50s, early 60s, he went and he had a sandwich board. He went out on Maxwell Street in Chicago with a sandwich board saying, paying cash for 78 RPM records, and he stood out there with fistfuls of dollar bills, and people just came running out of their apartments with stacks of old blues records. And, you know, I can't even imagine what kind of great stuff he got. They were only too happy to sell this stuff. So I remember that, and then had this conversation with Rich, and I just started putting ads in the Herald Times for paying cash for 78 RPM records, and people started calling me from all over Southern Indiana. And, you know, like, you go to those things, and 9 out of 10 of them they just don't really pay off.
Tommy Dorsey and
yeah, right. It's the stuff you always see, and, you know, I'm always glad to kind of, you know, meet people and see what their houses look like. But as far as record yield, it didn't pay off. But then, like, the 10th one, there'd be something just incredible. And I think that's true with all kinds of materials, not just records. What's some of the stuff that you found?
Well, I was doing research on this master's thesis that was written in 1927 of Ballads from Brown County.
Uh-huh.
No one has done anything with this master's thesis, first of all. It's just been sitting there on the shelf at the university library. And then I thought, I'm going to track this person down. So I did all the genealogical research type of stuff, looking online and using census records and that sort of thing. And finally, I just broke down, and she didn't have any children. She would have been over 100 years old. I put on Facebook in Brown County and just kind of put it out there that I was looking for information about this person. And somebody popped up and said, I don't have anything, but I know somebody who might. And I just found this treasure trove of old photographs of this person. And I've conducted oral histories with people about this woman that collected this material in the 1920s. And then right as I was getting ready to leave, I said, well, do you have anything else? And the man kind of said, well, I think I might have something you're interested in. And he came out and he brought a little stack of acetate recordings.
Oh, wow.
That was not of the woman that collected it, but of her mother, who is the woman whom she got a lot of the songs from.
Very cool. And so, was it her singing the song?
Yeah, it was her singing the songs from from like the 19 late 30s or something. So she was quite old at the time. It wasn't all the songs, but you could actually look then at the collection and then see this. The other person was I said, do you have anything of this other person that was the woman's grandfather she collected a lot of songs from? He says, I don't, but there's somebody that was on the other side of the family. So they're not a relative of ours, but we share a grandfather, or great-grandfather. Anyway, I went back and I did some more genealogical research, contacted the woman, and found these amazing kind of charcoal drawings from of portraits of he and his wife from the 1860s, 1870s, of this man in kind of the prime of his life. So it's like amazing material that all you have to do is ask.
Yeah, that's really cool. You know, I think that the two most powerful, well, the three most powerful tools in the world, but you know, specifically on doing historical research, are the internet and 6 degrees of separation, and the third sort of background layer being just the enormous amount of cataloging work that librarians and archivists did in the 20th century. And when you can combine those two or those three, which we can do now in a way that we absolutely could never have done before, you can just do an awful lot. And I think email is, you know, when we talk about the digital revolution, it's easy to forget how important email is to that. I was going through the papers of a guy who had done some research in the pre-internet days, and man, just sifting through all of his carbon papers and his requests for microfilm, it really made me aware. Like, this guy spent, like, I don't know, 40 years researching this one topic, and I thought, well, I could do almost all of this in about 3 hours, you know. And with having email and just like how quickly you can copy and paste and send out an email to, you know, a dozen or 100 people that used to take, you know, individual TypeScript letters and folding them all up and putting them in envelopes and mailing them and waiting for responses. It's not just that you can do all this faster. It's that once you have that speed, you can start to do it on a more complex level. And again, like, I think that's a real exciting thing about living in the age that we do. I think a lot of people have this mistaken notion that if you have the internet, you can just look everything up on it, and anyone who actually does the work knows that's just a silly notion. But what the power of the internet does is, I think, just makes you able to play a much more sophisticated instrument that takes in a lot more parts and adds up in a much more complex and rich way.
I agree, and I think we're just now seeing the tip of the iceberg on that front. I think about the Library of Congress putting so much of their image material in Flickr, for example.
Yeah, right.
You know, basically they're crowdsourcing annotation for images that they might have man and woman in front of barn from the WPA era. And then somebody can say, oh, I know who that is, or I think I know who that is. And all of a sudden, the material becomes that much richer.
And right. Now, the dark side of that is you can get a lot of misinformation that way. But the upside is you can get a lot of information that way.
Exactly.
And presumably useful information.
Exactly. And just like any type of historical research, just because you find it in the newspaper from a certain time, you don't believe it.
Right.
You've probably run across that a lot where you find...
Mostly when I'm in the newspaper.
Exactly. I stopped doing interviews a long time ago for that reason. So the everyday person out there, what, someone who's interested in genealogy, someone that's interested in local history, they have some images. What would you recommend for them to do if they want to find out more? And if they want to share them? And maybe that's a bad question.
It's a good question. It's just it's a big one. Because it depends on everyone's individual circumstances. One thing that I would recommend, certainly for anyone who works at a small institutional level or above, is there's so much material at the National Archives about local information. You know, so like the WPA put out a series of films called A Better, and then the state names, A Better Massachusetts, A Better New York, A Better Indiana. You know, there's not a complete set there, but there's a lot of them there. And, you know, there's a million things like that. There's old newsreels. I think it would, if I were a local researcher of any kind, I would tap into what materials they have at the National Archives and the Library of Congress and any other public institutions that related to local interest, and have a copy of it on the shelf at home and make it available to people in the community. You know, it's the cost of a trip to Washington, which may be incidental for some people and may be significant for others. But once you're there, you know, everything is free or close enough to it. And you can just get just a huge amount of material. Depending on where you're from, maybe you can't, but most places you can. You know, every summer I do a film night here in western Massachusetts, up at the top of Mount Greylock, the old CCC Lodge. I do a film night of local films, most of which come from Washington. Yeah, so I guess I would do that. And then I guess, you know, some version of putting the ad in the paper. Like, I think if you have a home movie day in your area, to be involved with that. And if you don't, go ahead and start one. But when you do if you do some sort of public presentation, it'll draw people out of the woodwork who have other material. So if you give a talk on whatever your area of interest is at the local historical society, or have a movie night, I mean, and it can be fun. It doesn't have to be boring and parochial. You know, you can do something kind of cool, or something with a national, you know, like many newspapers do, if you have the local angle on a national story. So whoever your local Vietnam veterans are, or you know, your draft resistors, you know, I mean, whatever the subject is, get the local people, have some national perspective, and the people who show up in the audience, I think, will have you know, a lot of it will be boring. This is why I don't do a lot of it, is because I just don't have the capacity for listening to too many stories. But if you're willing to sift through the boring stories, there's going to be some good ones in there, and there's going to be some good materials, whether they're photographs or films or sound recordings or just oral knowledge. I think that's a good thing that anyone can do. Of course, setting up a website too with what you're interested in is just sort of a magnet.
Right.
For a while, I had a website up saying I was buying home movies, and I got a bunch of hits on that, and picked up a bunch of people's home movies.
Well, that's cool.
And, you know, again, most of them sucked, but a few of them were pretty great.
That's neat. How about the internet eBay front? Does that work?
Oh, gosh, eBay, yeah, yeah. I first thing I do every morning is check my, the saved searches on eBay. First thing I do every morning is check to see what's come in.
I do the same thing in some of my areas of interest. Most of the time you don't find anything, but occasionally...
Thank God.
Exactly. I can't afford it.
If you found too much, you'd be broke, and it wouldn't be much fun. I think that's, you know, on the other side of the counter. I've had a lot of conversations with archivists who, you know, just are always expressing regret of how we don't save everything. It's like, well, we can't save everything. And also, if we could, it just wouldn't be engaging. You know, I liken it to Miles Davis's trumpet playing, where the cliche is, you know, it's not the notes he plays, it's the notes he doesn't play. And I think it's those absences and holes that make mysteries. And if you can have this archipelago of photographs and sound recordings and, you know, bits of historical information, that's what really makes it beautiful. It's that combination of what's present and what's missing. If you have too much, there's no engagement there.
You've been listening to Artists and Ancestors, with music by Martin Simpson and hosted by me, John Kay. I'd love to hear from the listeners out there to give me some ideas for future podcasts or folks to feature on the show. Let me know that you're listening out there, and until the next episode, keep up your research of the creative lives of people from the past.